Okay, it is 5 o'clock, so we'll go ahead and call the Monday, November 17th, 2025, Columbia Free Council to order. We have two items on our agenda. We have energy codes 101. And then we have a discussion around our snow and ice removal, which I've been told takes a solid hour, and that we have to save our questions for the end so they can get through it. So we'll try to start that before 6, Shane. I know it's a hot topic. Okay, so I'm going to kick it over, I assume, to Clint. All right.
Yes, thank you. And we'll try to keep it under an hour, so we have a lot of time to talk about snow and ice removal. So
Maybe hail removal, too.
So just to provide a little backdrop for the conversation tonight, as you know, early this year, the city initiated the review of the 2024 ICC family of building codes. That includes one particular code, which is the International Energy Conservation Code. In connection with the review of that code, our BCCC, which is our Building Construction Codes Commission, as well as our Columbia Environmental Commission, reviewed the environmental codes, or the energy, conservation codes. Tonight we will have a resolution on the main agenda, setting a 90-day period for those to be on display with the clerk. But working through our sustainability office as well, they ask a representative from the Midwest Energy Efficiency Alliance to come in and speak a little bit about what is in the energy code. I think there's a lot of interest in some of the regulations that will be coming before council when we do bring those 2024 codes forward in the future. And so Zoya with the MEEA is here to kind of speak on that. So I'm going to turn it over to her. She's going to give a little presentation, and afterward I think there'll be time for some question and comments. So okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Clint. You want to get to the microphone?
Yes, I can do that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zoya. I work for an organization called the Midwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, or MEEA. I'm really happy to be here today and talk to you about energy codes. I'm going to try and keep this under 45 minutes so you all have plenty of time to talk about your snow and ice removal, and so I can board my flight at 7 p.m. So I'm just going to go over the agenda a little bit. First, I'm just going to take us through a little bit of an introduction to MEEA. Who are we? What do we do? Why are we here preaching to you about energy codes? Talk a little bit about what an energy code is, some of the impacts of advanced energy codes, do a brief overview of the code adoption landscape in Missouri, and then I will walk through some comparisons between the last three versions of the energy code, so 2018 to 2015 to 2024, and talk a little bit about the cost of compliance and implementation of energy codes. Sound good? So MEEA is a nonprofit membership-based organization with over 170 members, and we work to advance energy efficiency in 13 states across the Midwest. We work to educate and advise a diverse range of stakeholders on the benefits to better understand and implement cost-effective energy efficiency strategies that provide economic, environmental, and public health benefits. We're part of a national network of regional energy efficiency organizations called RIOs. We work through funded partnerships with the US DOE. So we are the Midwest RIO. There are also RIOs in the Southwest, Northeast, Southeast, Northwest. California is doing its own thing. And our vision is an achievable pathway for all people and communities in the Midwest to enjoy the economic, environmental, and societal benefits of energy efficiency and the larger clean energy economy. I keep forgetting I have this clicker. So what is an energy code? An energy code is basically the minimum standards that dictate energy efficiency requirements for residential and commercial buildings. They serve as the floor of requirements, so they kind of designate the worst building that can legally be built. They are health and safety codes, just like any other building code, like plumbing or mechanical or electric. And they focus on the indoor environment, so thermal comfort, natural and artificial light, and ventilation. codes are developed nationally by two main organizations, the International Code Council, who develops the International Energy Conservation Code, or the IECC, and ASHRAE, which develops ASHRAE 90.1 standard, which creates additional commercial standards. These codes are updated every 3 years, but they're offset by 2 years. So ASHRAE comes out first, and then they publish commercial standards, and then the IECC comes out 2 years later and references the commercial standards in ASHRAE. So they are not competitors, they work together. Some places will also adopt in name the International Residential Code, or the IRC, or the International Building Code, or IBC, for commercial standards. The IECC Chapter 11, The International Residential Code Chapter 11 references the standards in the residential IECC, and Chapter 13 in the International Building Code references the energy efficiency standards in the IECC. So the corresponding IRC and IBCs to the IECC generally have the same energy efficiency requirements. That being said, ASHRAE 90.1 standard and the IECC are still the most commonly adopted codes. So national model codes are used as the basis for the energy code by the authority having jurisdiction, which can be a state, county, or municipality. Model energy codes can be amended, but there is a significant benefit to adopting a full and amended code in terms of energy savings and cost effectiveness. As far as adoption, there are two main ways that places will adopt an energy code. We have what we call min-max states, where states will adopt a statewide energy code. It is the minimum and maximum standard that you can have for energy efficiency requirements. So you can't build better, you can't build worse. That's not really relevant to you all because Missouri is a home rule state, so you do not have a statewide code, and municipalities and counties adopt their own energy code. Some home rule states actually do have a statewide energy code that's optional. The only home rule state in the Midwest that does that though is North Dakota. Regardless of who adopts the code is always enforced at a jurisdictional level through code officials. So energy codes serve as the minimum requirements for the building envelope, which includes insulation, windows, and air ceilings. They also cover mechanical equipment and lighting. The residential energy code covers buildings 2 stories or less that are used for basic residential purposes. Multifamily residential buildings over 3 stories are covered by the commercial code, as well as all other non-residential buildings. Energy codes generally apply to new construction. They can also apply to existing buildings in the case of major additions and renovations. So unlike most other codes, the energy code directly impacts the work of many disparate building trades and systems, including the brick envelope, plumbing, HVAC, electric, moisture management, concrete, and caulking. The energy code uses the whole house approach. This means that you should not take the policy as parts, as an amendment to one component of the energy code, like insulation levels, will probably mean that you end up having to change the sizing of the HVAC, and it just kind of throws off the whole thing. So just going into a little more of why the energy code is meant to be taken as a whole package. The energy code uses the scientific principles of the laws of thermodynamics. The first rule is that energy, in essence heat, only travels in one direction, hot to cold. The energy code is designed around the science of controlling heat transfer in buildings. So this law guides the recommendations made by the creators of the energy code. To visualize the mitigation process, we note that insulation is designed to slow the transfer of heat through wall walls, floors, and ceilings. And the code uses math and science to develop the best thermal values, or R values, which measures an insulation's effectiveness for each climate zone. So in essence, thermal values are values for the Alaska and Florida. So even though these seem like individual components as a list on paper, the energy code should be taken as a whole. Like I mentioned before, a reduction in value to one measure can negatively impact another component of the building. Requiring less insulation than the published code, for example, means that HVAC needs to be resized accordingly to compensate for this amendment. This doesn't mean that it's bad to amend the energy code. It just means that you maximize the benefits of the energy code by adopting the full unamended package. So now we're going to zoom out a bit and see why building codes, energy codes, are important and the implications they have. Buildings consume about 40% of total energy use in the U.S., oftentimes a larger percentage in major cities. For example, where I live in Chicago, buildings make up about 60% of our energy use. So energy codes can offer large energy savings, and they reduce the energy use for the lifetime of a building, which can be from 50 to well over 100 years, and cumulative savings continue to be seen year after year. The most cost-effective time to implement code measures is during initial construction rather than having to retrofit or retrocommission the building. Cost savings tend to be one of the most appealing parts of energy codes for many people. Building owners, operators, and tenants see lower utility bills and lower maintenance and replacement expenses when they use efficient appliances, and in that sense, codes do more for people and businesses while continuing to be responsible with our resources. Energy codes really are health and safety codes because of the health and resilience benefits that they provide, including better indoor air quality and less demand on the electrical grid, making the system more reliable for longer periods of time in the case of an emergency or extreme weather event like today. Regulations for moisture and the building envelope can be health precautions by reducing the risk of mold exposure, and stronger codes make buildings more resilient and promote community self-sufficiency. Implementing energy codes can also see benefits on the business and workforce side, by guaranteeing a minimum level of efficiency for all new buildings within a jurisdiction. They sort of level the playing field for market competition and provide opportunities to learn and utilize new and construction techniques, giving the industry a leg up on competition. So there really is a real human health benefit to energy retrofits and energy efficient buildings. We have seen this recently in a study commissioned by the Metropolitan Energy Center in Kansas City back in 2023. This study found a direct correlation between home weatherization, which generally includes added insulation, air sealing, and HVAC ductwork sealing, and a drop in pediatric asthma symptoms and hospitalizations associated with pediatric asthma. In fact, they found a 34% difference in asthma frequency and intensity between children in homes that had been weatherized versus the control group.
Okay. Can you move the microphone a little bit closer to you? Sorry, you're sometimes not looking at it. Yeah, thanks.
So, how do these codes affect...
Valerie, please use the microphone.
Oh my gosh. Right after you said that too, and thank you for taking questions. How do these codes affect already built housing, and does that depend on, I guess, the property owners and the use, whether it's rental or principal owner?
energy codes do primarily address new construction. Like I mentioned, they can apply to major alterations. There are other building efficiency policies that are designed to address energy use in buildings. These include benchmarking and building performance standards, which involve tracking and reporting and building's energy use over time, and setting goals for progressive energy reduction in a building. Codes in general don't really address existing buildings.
How did they get the statistic on across all eras on the previous slide?
The benefits of the energy weatherization, the weatherization was performed on all ages of homes. So like a home could have been 100 years old or 10 years old, still did the weatherization, and they saw benefits across all of those years.
Thanks for explaining that.
As I mentioned before, energy efficiency can also make buildings more resilient to extreme weather. This has been recognized at federal level. FEMA released a new building code strategy back in 2022, basically targeting funding or tying funding to the update of energy codes in jurisdictions receiving aid. Focuses on three core goals: integrating building standards and codes across FEMA, strengthening our nationwide capability for superior building performance, and driving public action on building codes. The grant program that is tied to this strategy is called Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, or BRIC, and it is continuing through this next fiscal year. So just to take a look at the code adoption landscape in Missouri, and just kind of seeing how Columbia compares to other cities in the state, we have yet to see an adoption of the 2024 IECC at the residential or commercial level in Missouri. I know that St. Louis County is in the process of reviewing the 2024, and I recently reviewed the 2024 earlier this year. Yeah, we have seen a lot of updated code adoptions to the 2018 and the 2021 and some interest in the 2024. So this is the residential adoption landscape. And then we have the commercial landscape, which is pretty similar. In general, commercial adoptions tend to be truer to the model energy code because we see fewer weakening amendments on commercial energy codes. However, as far as all of these jurisdictions, we have not seen any significant amendments on the residential energy code. So going over the last few code cycles and kind of seeing how the code has evolved to become more efficient or more flexible or more cost effective, from 2015 to 2018, the efficient lighting requirement was increased to 90%, meaning that 90% of all light fixtures installed in a building needed to be classified as high efficacy. And the energy rating index compliance path was weakened between the 2015 and 2018. Between 2018 and 2021, the efficient lighting requirement was increased to 100%. The ERI pathway was strengthened again, and notably the 2021 added section R408, which requires additional energy efficiency credits for the prescriptive and performance pathways. I'll be talking a little bit more about these compliance pathways in the coming slides. So if you're like, what are you talking about? We're getting there. And then from 2021 to 2024, insulation requirements became more flexible. Those R408 additional energy efficiency requirements were kept for the prescriptive compliance pathway, but removed from the performance pathway, making the performance pathway more flexible and a little less expensive to implement. And the energy rating index values for the ERI pathway were adjusted to be different to account for on-site and off-site power production.
And for reference, City right now is operating on the 2018 right. Suite of codes.
Also, just overall between the 2015 and the 2024, there were increases in the efficiency of envelope requirements, and each new model code has been deemed cost effective by the U.S. Department of Energy. So when I talk about the performance pathway and the prescriptive pathway, I'm talking about the different options that there are to comply with the energy code and meet the requirements. The prescriptive pathway is more of a checklist of requirements. You kind of just go down the list and you're like, okay, I met this insulation value and I have 100% efficient lighting. And in the 2021 and the 2024, the prescriptive pathway includes section R408, which requires you to meet a certain number of credits. So you can kind of see in this chart, there's a list of measures that are tied to a certain credit value. I believe in the 2024 IECC, you're required to meet a minimum of 10 of these credits, but you can kind of pick and choose which ones you use to get there. The performance pathway is more of a choose your own adventure model. It's based on an annual energy cost. So the annual energy cost of the proposed design needs to be less than or equal to the annual energy cost of the standard reference design, which is basically a hypothetical model home. Between 2021 and 2024, it became a little more flexible because those R408 additional energy efficiency credit requirements were removed from the performance pathway. It's a little less expensive and more flexible to implement, so it is a little more popular with builders. I believe you've only issued one prescriptive permit in Colombia for the 2018, so in general, the performance pathway tends to be more popular. So with the inclusion of several alternative compliance pathways, the 2021 IECC and the 2024 IECC offer project level flexibility, allowing builders to take different pathways for the same goals. So for example, there are three compliance pathways for residential buildings in the 2021 IECC. And two compliance pathways for commercial buildings, as well as an option to comply with the standards of ASHRAE standard 90.1 2019 instead of complying with the IECC. These additional options generally were supported by builders during the development of these codes since they do help ease the cost of construction. And generally, of all of the building codes, the IECC is the only one that provides a payback to the homeowner via energy and utility cost savings. So these are just kind of putting some numbers to how much it adds to the cost of construction to build to a new code. So these are really also simplified numbers. They refer only to the cost of building a single family residential building. It gets a little stickier to measure the cost of building to the commercial code just because there's some more variables, and commercial buildings can vary a lot in size and use type. But I do have the resource that these numbers came from, so I'm happy to share that in the follow-up materials. But to build from the 2009 and jump all the way to the 2021 IECC, it adds about $7,200 to the cost of construction. And then from 2021 to 2024, obviously it's a smaller jump, so it's quite a bit cheaper, adding about $200, $300 to the cost of construction.
Yeah, question.
So we're using 2018. I suppose that same thing holds from 2018, 21, and 21, So these numbers are we comparing these to, are these 2009 numbers, these 2024 numbers that we're comparing here? By that I mean, are we comparing apples to apples on terms of cost? In 2009, the average would have been 72. I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a difference in what materials cost now versus what they cost in 2009, for instance. So I'm wondering if this is comparative in terms of 2009 to 2024.
I believe it does account for the increased cost of materials, but in general, this kind of just covers the cost of standards. And it does hold that to jump from the 2018 to the 2024, it's a larger incremental cost, especially because 2024 adds those additional energy efficiency credits. So that prescriptive pathway becomes a bit more expensive. And also, those are national averages. In Missouri, going from the 2021 to the 2024 is actually a reduction in incremental cost. And then, as you can see, it can be between $3,000 and $4,200-ish to go from the 2018 to 2024. That range covers gas and electric homes.
Is that a positive? So it has increased 3,000, or is that a decreased 3,000?
The cost to build to the new code increases 3,000.
Thank you.
And can I clarify, the prescriptive pathway, that was the one that we, under our current codes, have only seen one. Like, that's not the most popular way. So does that mean, because you say right there that the addition to those requirements for the prescriptive pathway are in part why that higher cost. So is it a 3,000 to 4,000 potential additional increase for regardless of which pathway you take?
It's for the prescriptive path. The cost to build to the performance pathway varies a lot more just because it is a choose your own adventure and you can make more trade-offs. So I don't have a concrete number for the performance pathway.
Do you have any data on the experience of other users that have taken the performance pathway? Can we look at individual data points and get a perspective? Is that even helpful?
I'm sure it exists. It probably is in one of the reports that I referenced for this presentation, so I'm happy to share that in all of the materials as well.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks.
So, just to kind of dive into more of what makes the energy code cost effective. We have seen some inflated estimates on what it costs specifically to build to the 2021 residential IECC. We have seen this in Kansas City. We have seen this in Minnesota and Missouri with their updates to the 2021 and 2024 IECC. But we have seen claims that it costs at least $32,000 to build to the 2021 IECC. Yes, it can cost more to update your code. This $32,000 estimate isn't really a complete picture. It generally only accounts for the prescriptive pathway, and as I've been mentioning, there are two other compliance pathways in the 2021 and the 2024 that offer more flexibility and more potential cost savings. So as an example, under the performance pathway, a builder can construct a tighter building envelope, in essence one that causes less leakage, and then trade off that efficiency so that additional insulation in the walls and the roof isn't required. That number often includes double-counted measures, such as a double-wall home, which we have seen cited towards that cost. The 2021 IECC does not require a double-wall. And it also accounts for double-counted measures. So They'll go through and add up measures that count towards both the prescriptive and the performance pathway. All of that to say, it shouldn't cost $32,000 to build to a new code because of the flexibility offered by the performance and ERI pathways. And the 2024 is even more flexible and is generally more popular in the industry because it doesn't have those additional energy efficiency requirements from section R408. There are a lot of other factors that affect the cost of new construction, including rising mortgage interest rates, inflation and tariffs, supply chain shortages, the jurisdiction where the home is built. This is probably the biggest factor contributing to the rise in construction costs. The cost per square foot to build varies by location, independent of energy code requirements. And the size of the home is a factor. Generally, the size of single family homes has increased over time. That's not to say that the energy code does not contribute to rising construction costs. It's just not the only factor. And like I've said, the IACC is the only one that provides a payback to the homeowner.
Yep. Does evolution in technology have an impact on the cost as well? I mean, for instance, energy efficiency lighting, I think has reduced in cost over time, and I don't know about other elements, but that I assume that's part of the reason that that factors into this as well. Is that right?
Sorry, can you?
Well, I think we're comparing. I'm trying to compare what was to what is, and to build to this standard in 2018 might be different than it is now because of changes in technology that have reduced the cost of some elements of it. Is that accurate or not?
Yes, I would say so.
Okay.
And finally, just to kind of tie it back together and discuss some of the long-term benefits of the energy codes, these benefits can reach a variety of entities, including homeowners and occupants who enjoy lower utility bills and more comfortable and resilient homes, state and local governments, energy codes can help them achieve community-wide reductions in both energy demand and greenhouse gas emissions should they have a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. These benefits also reach builders and developers who can receive recognition and more advanced professional development for constructing properties that represent the latest technologies and standards, and utilities, which can attribute savings to energy efficiency program. And I did mention this previously, but the long-term benefits of energy codes tend to outweigh the one-time cost. They provide a payback over the lifetime of the building, and they contribute to improved public health, economic growth, decreased demand on the grid, and more resilient buildings. And yeah, they really are an investment towards the future. That's me.
That's
my face.
All right. Questions for Victoria or for staff on this? Okay. I would just really quick before we get into our questions, Clint, you mentioned at the very beginning that the codes we have a resolution on this evening about having them on file at the clerk's office, the required 90-day hold. Will you walk through a little bit for council, especially those that are newer, what the process is for how Columbia reviews our building codes and the role of, you know, the Building Construction Codes Commission, and then how does that recommendations then come to us?
Yeah, no, sure. So typically, I think as Zoya had stated, so every 3 years, you know, this international team will get together and basically produce a new set of building codes. So the most recent one's 2024. And so I think it was beginning of 2020 or end of 2023, our standing Building Construction Codes Commission, you know, they were aware that the new codes had been published and were available. And so they sent a report to the council requesting permission, in essence, to begin that review period. So it wasn't to approve anything. It's for them to actually begin reviewing through that, through all the different codes. And so as she'd stated there, There's residential codes, there's commercial codes, plumbing codes, electrical codes, mechanical codes. So there's a whole suite of different codes. And so the Building Construction Codes Commission also has many subcommittees that are a little more focused on those particular aspects of individualized codes. And that's also where our Environmental Commission came in too. They sat with that subcommittee with the BCCC on the energy conservation codes, offered some of their expertise and guidance on reviewing and potentially adopting and recommending the adoption of that code. And so they spent, I think, approximately 6 months or so, I think, reviewing 6 to 8 months, four to six months. They went through essentially all the significant changes from the 2018, which is what we have right now, to that 2024 code. And they put together basically a set of amendments as well. And so it's very common for municipalities to offer what we call local amendments that kind of tailor it specifically to some of the nuances within a community. So in addition to the model codes, which is the entire code, we'll have a few select amendments that will come forward with the proposal as well. That will be a little bit different than the international code. So we adopt that in addition to the model codes and change a few of the things in there. Typically the process to have the 90-day review period would have been a little bit earlier, but there was a delay in actually having physical codes. And actually it's kind of worked out, I think, in our favor to delay that period because we have the review completed and we're kind of taking it and kind of piggybacking on top of it. More of an outreach at this point. So talking with staff, we feel like with some of the nuance, I think, with this building code and some of the concerns with the cost, it's going to be a good idea to kind of have a little bit more of a public-facing side with this code adoption, which isn't something really that's been done in the past with building codes. It's usually a little more straightforward process. The BCC reviews it, sends it to council. It's approved, it's not approved. And just a little reference, they did review the 2021 codes, and those did come to council. And they at that time decided not to adopt them. I think there were concerns with the cost within those 2021 codes as well. We currently have, I think, what the recommended code adoption would be, and that's what's on file with the clerk's office. We'll also be putting that on the Be Heard site. And they're, fairly technical in scope. And so we do want to make sure that anyone that has specific technical questions can answer that or ask that through the Be Heard site. They can also call our offices. You don't have to go through the Be Heard site, but it's helpful to get it through Be Heard. And we'll take some of those that are more common questions too, and we'll try to answer them on there and post those. So there's a little bit more of a reference for people coming that if they have some of those same questions, they can just read through those frequently asked questions and get those questions answered. And so after that 90-day period is completed, then those codes could come before council for adoption. I don't want to set a particular timetable, I think, for that adoption right now. We want to go through the 90-day period and really, make sure we're getting a breadth of I think, voices from the community and our stakeholders on what their kind of viewpoints are on the impacts of those codes. We definitely want to reach out, I think, to some of our ones that I think people would take, would know that are have particular interest in that, our home builders groups, our commissioner, our engineering teams, our economic development teams. So we want to hear from all those because I think, the real important question here, obviously, is that is if there is a increased cost in construction with the adoption of some of these codes, is that cost benefit, beneficial as a community? Do we think that's the way we want to go? And so we want to make sure we're getting all the voices together, having all the facts together, too. And then we'll bring that back before council. I think we'll have probably a period of time where we're going to review a lot of the feedback we got from Be Heard and from the community. So I wouldn't necessarily anticipate having a report or recommendation right at, in April or March. But at some point we'll bring back, I think, a recommendation to council on the potential adoption of those codes. So that's kind of the medium length version of I think what our path forward here would be.
Thank you. Any questions for staff before we can talk about snow? Yeah, I'll go with Valerie and then Tom.
I did. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how we step new applicants for building permits through these codes and the different pathways and how, what changes about that procedure when we have a significant code change?
Sure, and that's, it's funny, we actually just had that conversation with our, my team this afternoon, knowing that that is something that's gonna be very important going forward. And I don't wanna go too far in saying exactly how we're going to address that, but I say typically, you know, prior to the adoption of code, if you have a billing application into the offices, then you would be considered to have submitted that before the adoption of that new code. So I don't want to commit ourselves to anything, but that's typically how it's been handled in the past. So I expect something of that nature to be in place before we get too much further down the line. I think that'd be something we'll probably start putting out on the Be Heard side as far as what builders and what the construction community can expect when those adoption of the 24 codes, if we get to that point, what that's going to look like as far as what code they need to design new projects to.
Do we have education opportunities for the public after it's in implementation?
I think we're open to doing whatever is needed. Okay. We're, like I said, we have the site now. We're going to have a public forum too in December. We don't have a date exactly set right now, but we wanted to have an opportunity to you know, sit with people in person and have those questions asked, and we can field those in real time. If we need to have more of those, we can absolutely do that. And if we need to do some after an adoption and before they go into effect, we can absolutely do that too. And I'm sure our team, and I have our building regulation supervisor and our engineering manager from our building and site development team here, I'm sure they're going to make sure that we have a good plan in place to make sure that all builders and the construction community know what's coming down the pipe for this.
Yeah, a couple things that I would like to see on the Be Heard as you're building this out. I know you mentioned technical aspects of it. As much as you can, maybe kind of dumb it down for those of us that aren't experts in some of this, so that we can all maybe kind of get a better grasp on it. And two, I know there's flexibility and it's difficult to determine additional costs with performance versus prescriptive. But on the performance side, I would really like to see, as best you can, this is what it's the additional cost. I know over, as you pointed out, over a 30-year lifespan or over a 30-year mortgage, significant savings to the homeowner. Anecdotally, I know Brian Toohey could probably answer this question better, but I think it's very unusual for somebody to build a house and stay in it for 30 years. Okay, so, and the reason I'm asking about costs is we're, part of our discussion is housing and affordable housing. And, you know, if this is great, but if we make that initial barrier, it's just going to be making that initial hurdle, not, you know, to get into more difficult. So we need to evaluate that. I think we need to have that information out there anyway, so that we can evaluate it, you know, as to, as we move forward. Again, I think it's great. I went, you know, took advantage of the city's program several years ago, new furnace, new, you know, attic insulation, the whole bit. And yeah, it made a difference once I figured out to use gas heat instead of heat pump, but that's another story. So yes, I'm all for it. But again, if we're talking about affordable housing and building affordable housing, let's not make it, again, make that initial hurdle insurmountable for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And just kind of address, I think, the first thing you said. So I envision there being kind of two audiences for that building code. So we probably will have a little more technical side to it, because we do want to answer those specific questions, but we may have...
Sure, for the... Right.
We'll probably have, you know, less technical questions and answers as well. So I think there'll be a little bit on there for anyone who's interested in kind of learning or asking questions about the building code.
And then I'm going to move us along in about 5 minutes.
Okay. I was just wondering if this presentation will be made available to us after tonight.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. And maybe also put it on the Be Heard site. Can I clarify for you, Zoya, on the one that had the savings quote of the estimated savings, that was over 30 years, correct? So the 2,500 was over 30 years, 15,000, if we take out the cost to it. So that would be like a $500 a year savings for that. I just want to make sure I was reading that correct.
About.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And I just want to say too, I think she had some numbers on the expected increase in building costs from what we will be doing, which is 2018 to 2024. You know, we've done some, I think, real basic, I think, calculations here internally, nothing official, and I think we came in a little higher than that. So I just want to recognize, I think there are different perspectives on what that cost will be. So I don't want to set necessarily the expectation of one number. And I think that's part of this conversation of working with our groups to say, you know, what standards do we need to look at to really come to those costs?
I think that would be very useful and appreciative, because we definitely are hearing the concerns to Don's point about affordable housing and making sure that the payoff is there for people. So, okay. Anything else? No, we'll appreciate it. I hope you can make your flight. Thanks for coming down. Chicago, we have a direct flight to Chicago, multiple opportunities for you. You can go. Thank you.
Great. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
My email is up here, and Clint and Eric will share these slides. So if you have any questions about Mia or with the work we do in codes, or just want to talk about codes, feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to chat.
Thanks. Thank you. So I think something that would be useful to know for you to be thinking about is, as you guys are comparing places that have locally adapted versus statewide, what that sort of performance and what is more beneficial to communities? Is it statewide or to have these sort of flexible local? Yeah, would be good to know.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. Richard Stone and Shane Creech, come on down. Oh, and Lee. Sorry, Lee. Lee White, too. Oh yeah, so Shane has like 64 slides that he says they're gonna go through fast, but I'm gonna have us save our questions till the end, so make sure you note down, and there are page numbers or slide numbers on there, so you should be able to reference back. So, Shane. Yeah.
Good evening. Shane Creech, Director of Public Works. Richard Stone, the Engineering Operations Manager, is with me tonight. Biggest reason to do that is I wanna make sure we come out of this with you all having a good understanding of how we handle winter weather. Questions about how we do it, why we do it.
Is your microphone on, Shane? I noticed this with this person earlier, and I was like, is she just the quietest?
It didn't seem to make any difference.
Oh my gosh.
That's amazing. Wow.
Let's have the person repeat her performance.
Yeah. Or not.
So anyway, the major reason I want to hold questions to the end is because I want you all to come out of here with how we handle winter weather right now. We can have all kinds of conversations about doing it a different way, but that probably won't change how we handle it this year. The resources that I have at my disposal right now are probably going to be that way through the winter. We probably couldn't change that fast. And so I want to make sure you come out of here with a good understanding of that. And then when we get into questions, we can talk about all kinds of different stuff. But I think that's the best way to handle that. So I will turn it over to Richard Stone, again, who's the Engineering Operations Manager.
We'll see here. Is that working?
Yes, thank you.
So I'm the Engineering Operations Manager, so pretty much street division, center B. Kind of give you an idea, this information is not static, changes over time, it has changed over time. We made a pretty aggressive overhaul in 2012. What I'm gonna show you now has sort of been changed around the edges since then. It's a methodical approach to try to do the best we can with the resources that we have to be as efficient as possible. So from a high level perspective, what we're trying to do is basically the home base is people achieving safe travel, right? So the best way to get people around town, because if we don't do our job, basically the town shut down. So we do not control Mother Nature or other agencies. There are some pretty major roadways within the city, Stadium, Grindstone, Providence, Business Loop. Those are roadways maintained by MoDOT. We do have conversations with them about their staffing and what they're doing, but they're responsible for those roadways. That doesn't mean that we won't plow on those roadways. Our plows typically are down if we're on their roadways, unless we know for a reason that we shouldn't have our plow down. Like, we can kind of spot when they've treated a roadway. We don't want to push that salt off there. So if you see a truck that's driving around with a plow up on a roadway that's still got some level of snow on it, it's because we understand that that hasn't just been treated. So we kind of, between all of the agencies, we work together. We do, on some of the outskirts, we'll take over some of the county roadways, and then they'll take over ours. And anything to do with maintenance, the maintenance agreement or roadway maintenance, it's just how we can best efficiently do our jobs. We do control our resources, our planning. And I talk pretty loud, so hopefully that works. So, yeah, we react to what's happening. So, try it again. No?
I think it must be battery thing. Just try.
Now, this one goes out. What do I do?
We have more.
Okay. So we have a hierarchy because we can't be everywhere all at once. We have a hierarchy of first, second, third priority streets, and then all the other streets that were within town. So that's the approach that we've taken, methodical pattern. So equipment and resources are built over time. So we built this over a decade plus with the resources we have to do the most efficient job that we possibly can. Any winter weather response for any agency is typically when you're changing things, you're normally talking about that in May, June, July, trying to make those adjustments for the future years. 100 degrees is a good time to be talking about snow for me. Winter weather information is on our website, www.comosnow.com. And that takes you to a website that's got basically all of what we do. On that is a map, and we'll get into to that a little bit later. Internally, we treat all winter weather events as a disaster because that's what they are. And the reason why we do that is so that everybody can understand what's going on internally within the city when we're talking to each other about what's happening. The incident command system was developed by was generally developed by firefighting in California in the 70s. Several firefighters got killed. What they found out was communication was the main reason for that, lack of communication. So over time, that emergency response process has been developed. It's called National Incident Management System, Incident Command Structure, Incident Command System. That's what we utilize so that mostly, the most important thing is that joint communication knows what we're doing, who to contact, how things are happening, and then I'm sending it out internally to people so that they know what's going on. It's updated every 12 hours, a shift change, or if there's a major change that's happening. To kind of give you an idea of what the ICS looks like, this is ICS information, so you have a map, and then you'll have what our planned activities are. Next page is going to have some detail about what has happened, what we're planning on doing, another page of information about contacts, and then our resources that we're applying to the event. So very methodical approach. It changes for every event. So you ever hear me utter the word typical? I probably won't, but if I do, I mean often. So there is no typical storm when it comes to winter weather. So to kind of give you an idea, we have information back. I had information from 2012 and 13 as well, but we have basically, if you want to know about what happened across any winter weather event or any winter weather season, we have all that information. So generally about 10 to 12 events can be down to four each year, each winter season, to kind of give you an idea, but it can be 25 too. So. City currently maintains 1,465 lane miles. So lane mile is 12 foot wide, 1 mile long. So we maintain 1,465 lane miles within the city. So basically a 12 foot strip of pavement from here to Miami, Florida. That's what we're responsible for maintaining. Because we can't be everywhere, this first, second, third priority system is in place. We have 691 lane miles, and we have one salt dome that's located off of Big Bear, which is just north of, on the north side of the interstate, on the east side of Rangeline Road. So one 5,000 ton salt dome. Priority routes are generally continuous operations, and the reason for that, as we'll get into it a little bit, is to make sure that we have a bare wheel path at a minimum at all times. That can get overwhelmed depending on the rate of snow. Typically about 1 inch per hour is enough to overwhelm the pavement depending on temperatures. Could be a quarter inch is enough to overwhelm the pavement if you have really cold temperatures. We'll get into that. But, the idea was to create a buffer zone around all the city so that there is some sort of continuous route within, and this has fluctuated over time, and we've been able to reduce it down to about 1,000 feet. That doesn't mean that every residence is within 1,000 feet. I think 800 feet is pretty good target to eventually get to. But we add subdivisions, so we have to add priority routes. We're trying to keep that, you know, about two blocks away, so somebody could park on a street about two blocks away if they need to get out, right? Third priorities allow for parking. First and seconds do not allow for parking with over 2 inches of snow. We have 14 tandems. Three of those are basically on life support. They're just barely operational, but our fleet is keeping them around. We have deferred equipment replacement for about 10 years. It's been pretty low. However, council and city management increased our speed of our replacement for fleet, which is going to make a lot of difference with this, the fleet that we do have. 2 years ago, made a big investment. This year, also made a big investment. And hopefully, we'll continue to do that to update our fleet, because if they're in the shop getting fixed, they're not out there on the road. So we do have 12 one-tons that do help too, and five class fives, which is a bigger vehicle other than a one-ton that doesn't require a CDL operator. So it was an attempt to allow for a little more response without CDL operators. They haven't worked out as good as we'd like to, so we're not adding any of those, but we're going to keep those in the fleet and allow them to go out. We do have a different type of, it's basically a little bit smaller than that, but a little bit bigger than a one-ton that we're going to get this year to sort of test that out as well. So we do have four tandems and one single axle that should be delivered yet this winter. Two of those should be delivered by the end of November, and then the other three maybe by the end of January or in February, to give you an idea. And it costs about $280,000 to $300,000 for a fully outfitted dump truck with all of the snow equipment. And it takes about a year to a year and a half, depending on supply chain and stuff, to get one. So when you order it, it's a year away at the minimum, although some of that is improving. We have about 8 to 30 drivers per shift. Street division itself has 45 FTEs, so full-time equipment employees, 45. We have four vacancies right now. That means that there's less than 20 operators out there. We just use street division answering the call. That means that we borrow resources from other departments, and city manager and management is, you know, constantly making sure that everybody understands it's pretty important. If you don't have the, if you're not having to answer the call to your other duties, then we want you on snow duty. And we generally have about 5 to 15 people that fit that category on a regular basis. So we normally will have, typically, it's a bad word for me, but somewhere around 24 to 28 operators that are out there, plus some other help. So 8 to 12 inches of snow, we're getting into territories that are not normal, for sure. And then we get into more of a mode of having conversations as we're approaching that. Hey, this is what we're looking at. almost always really depends on what the temperature is going to be on the backside. Temperatures are really low, then we need a lot more people to be hitting that thing as fast as we can. Most communities target about 20 to 35 light miles per operator. And the reason for that is generally the best national research has shown the best operating speed for snow plowing is about 24 miles an hour. You got to go less than that when you're in city streets. If you're on a kind of wide open highway, that's a pretty good speed. You can do the efficiently take care of the snow. So some agencies will push it up to a little higher lane mile per operator if they've got, you know, wide open places. But when you're getting into tighter corners, you have to decrease that. So if we just had street division, we're about 35 lane miles per operator. With the other resources we get, we're about 25. So we're right there where other communities are. With our first, second, third priority indications. So less than 4 inches of snow, we go curb to curb, continuous operation with tow vehicles off of the first and second priority routes. We do that with social media. You can sign up to be notified that you're going to get towed. For first and seconds, that first event, when we know we're going to get pretty close to that, we'll be putting out flyers on people's cars if they're parking in places, because my ideal is to never tow a car, have them move voluntarily, because towing them is really problematic. I got resources that are going to that. I don't ever tow anybody. I just want you to move. So what we're trying to get to is something like this, 24, 36 hours after the end of the event. And we hit that most of the time. Again, weather or temperatures really matter. Neighborhood streets, we still address those during normal business operations, normal business hours, so 7 to 3:30. We'll run what's called run calls if we think that we're in good shape as far as passable conditions. People are still saying they can't get out of their neighborhoods, but we'll go down there and address that. Typically, 48 hours or less is generally the end of continuous operations. So 4 inches greater than snow, we do first, second, thirds, curb to curb, continuous operations, and again, tow those vehicles off of neighborhood route or off of those routes, and we're reaching into those neighborhoods on the thirds, third priorities. Sometimes we'll address people only to first priorities. Most of the time, we'll go first and seconds at the same time. They can handle those two. And then we'll reach about every 4 hours or so, or 8 hours into the neighborhoods on the thirds. All streets are passed, are plowed and treated to a passable condition. So a passable condition was something that we came up with and we've developed over time. Passable by a front wheel drive vehicle at slow speeds utilizing reasonable winter weather driving. And that's basically making sure we're addressing conditions that are out there, but being reasonable with the resources that we're putting to bear. To give you an idea of what some of this can look like, it can be gray to gray to gray, or it could look like this depending on temperatures. So all of these streets are passable conditions. The one on the bottom, I would say, is marginally passable. So that's as bad as we would want to see any street be after we're done with our operations. And the reason why we do this is salt is ineffective at less than 15 degrees. So rock salt is. So once you get below 15 degrees with no sun, the pavement temperatures aren't coming up. You can apply a lot more salt to it and it's still going to stay there. So we're trying to get that, the ability for people to get around. If you have a rear wheel drive vehicle, you may not get around as well. Kind of give you an idea. These two photos were taken about 4 hours apart. So the first one was 10 degrees, 3 degrees overnight, and it was about 10 degrees air temperature right at the beginning of the morning. So it was coming up. However, it continued to climb throughout the day. At the end of the day, it was about 30, 4 degrees, so all the time it was climbing, sun was shining, pavement temperatures rose. The salt that is on that street, so the one on the left, the salt that is on that street started working, right? So these two streets were a little ways away from each other, but they're only about 4 hours apart. So based on council direction, a lot of factors that limit all of this stuff, the resources we're putting to bear, but impact to the environment is one, and that is mandated. We do have an impaired stream within the community. Chloride does impact the waterways, so we're trying to limit that amount of sodium chloride that's getting to the water. Doesn't mean that all of it that we put on the street gets there, but some of it does. There is a research organization that is monitoring that, trying to figure out how much we're impacting those streams. We're in communication with them, and we understand what's going on with it. There are potentially better chemicals. Chemicals, not a bad word, but better chemicals or different chemicals that we can use to give us a chance to reach down a little bit deeper into colder temperatures. But we need different storage. We need different ways to applicate that equipment. So again, burn it off is not the right attitude. Each driver is that's out there when we're in on 4 inches of snow and we're getting, they get one of these books, so they know exactly where everything is. There's streets that's out of this book. So they know where to go. If there's a cul-de-sac that's off of it, they'll communicate back and forth with the supervisor or another person that's assigned to E5 right next to it. Like, I'll go ahead and hit that, but we'll make sure that every street is plowed and treated when it's over 4 inches of snow. So they report back to their supervisor that they're done with a location, and we'll do some inspection to make sure that that's the case. You'll have some events that are really kind of odd. We had that last year. We had two events close together, and we had some freeze and thaw after sleet. Sleet is typically just pebbly snow. It's pretty easy to take care of. However, when it gets covered up and it sticks and it stays and you got freeze and thaw, it turns to ice. So we monitored that situation. We had streets that were completely gray to gray to gray, curb to curb to curb to gray. And then we had other streets that were basically 150, 300 feet away, that were ice covered. So we answered that with some backhoes, actually removed that ice, be able to get around. So just because our plan was to plow and treat every street and then we're done, that wasn't what we did, and it would not be what we would do. So historically, in order to be as reasonable as we can for all the citizens, as equitable as we can, we'll go inside to out or outside to in, depending on the last snow. So we go inside to out one event for 4 inches, and then out next time we'll go outside to in. That's the best way we can come up with it. It's a little bit more efficient to go outside in, not much, but a little bit more efficient because you're not driving over the same streets, but it's not enough to make a difference on our response. So if completed and considered passable, it's like all green on the map, and people are still having a hard time to get out, then that's when we release the contact center to let us know to go ahead address that street a little bit more, right? So then we're answering calls on those streets. If they're calling in while it's snowing or while the event is going on or while our operational response is going on, yes, I'm addressing it. But once we said it's all green, then they're still contacting us saying they can't go in, then we'll go ahead and check that. So we have a methodical approach. We have a plan and we work the plan. There is no typical event. There are some guidelines. FHWA has done quite a bit of research on this, and I encourage you to go and take a look at this. MoDOT's EPG guide for anti-icing. There are five types of events that are listed on there with, again, before, after, or before, during, and after types of approaches. It's about 260 different items on a matrix of decision-making. But this gives us a chance to say, do this, and this is the approach that will give you the best results. There are limitations on equipment, so we don't all have the ability to do this, but we try to hit this. And essentially, what you're trying to do is get a grain of salt or a thing of rock salt about every 1 foot in most types of events. So that's enough to address the conditions that are out there. As you get colder, it gets harder, so you might go up to, say, 100 pounds per lane mile. We may go up to 200 pounds per lane mile. So 6 inches of snow or greater, we might trigger downtown snow removal. Downtown snow removal, the reason why we remove snow from downtown, there's no place to put it, right? So once you get up to a certain amount, the next storm that is coming is going to put some extra snow on there, so we've got to get it out of there. I'll do it sometimes at 6 inches. I've done it at 5 inches because I had other events coming and it was going to be cold. I've not done it at 10 inches because it was 45. It's going to be 45 degrees 2 days later, a day later. So kind of depends. Again, before, during, and after. Give you an idea of what it looks like. It's a presentation all on its own. We use backhoes to pile basically into the middle of the intersections, and then we load it up into dump trucks or roll off containers and haul it. Currently, we have an agreement with the university. We haul it to the Mizzou North site, and we remove basically from Worley to Rollins, everything that's in that Providence to college. And again, that's triggered as part of the process thing. 12 inches of snow or greater, again, we're getting into areas that are different, but we've handled 20 inch snows. The worst one, and we may get this in next week, is ice. Ice is its own animal, and it requires a lot of things to happen. So first and seconds on 12 inches or greater snow, probably going to take at least 2 days just to get through first and seconds. We may be on firsts for an entire day, or maybe a little longer. Firsts are typically around hospitals. You know, we're trying to address emergency vehicle response. So longer term horizon, we kind of give you an idea of what we're looking for. My folks have this thing basically embedded into their brain. What we've been doing, I'm a big proponent of change, but what we've been doing has not been wrong. We've been doing it the best we can with what we've had to work with. However, if in 5 years we're doing it the same way, we're doing it wrong. So they're really good about that. We've got really efficient over the years with the resources we've had, and we continue to live by that. So we evaluate first and second, third priorities, discuss whether additional parking modifications, maybe on third priorities, would help. Park cars are one of the worst things that we can have to deal with because they're big pieces of equipment. However, we like that because we can tell people we'll park up there instead of down at the bottom of your cul-de-sac. Priority neighborhoods, so we instituted this a few years back. You can't just call in and say, I want to be a priority neighborhood. I'm on mine first, right? It requires them to do something. So they have to, the person that's the contact has to go and make sure everybody's aware that they're a priority neighborhood and have those cars removed so that we can get in there and knock that neighborhood out really quick. I can do some neighborhoods that are pretty good size in an hour and a half at night because there's nothing in my way, right? So that is really beneficial. However, like last year and a couple times, we'll get people, it's like, hey, there's no cars here. And then we'll show up and there's cars everywhere. So we've instituted a policy, take a picture, and we leave them until we respond to them normally, right? And sometimes they're upset. We thought we were a priority neighborhood. Well, we had cars parked on the street. So generally, we have possibly too many of these priority neighborhoods right now. We're definitely at the top threshold if everybody called in. But normally, we're getting into them at night. And if they do their job, then it's really going to help us speed up the response for everybody. So based on council direction, we've also explored looking at a pilot for subdivisions to do their own snow removal. However, we've not been successful at that. Some people are like, well, we just want you to only sometimes, you know, we only want to do it sometimes. It's like, we have a responsibility to address their street, right? So it's either all or none. If they wanted to do a pilot and have us help pay for a contractor to do their subdivision, they have to take the responsibility, at least that's our opinion, that they have to take the responsibility completely for snow removal. That way we have a contract with them. They're going to do it. We're not. That's the only approach that I see at work. Like, there's too many chances of somebody on their side being gone, somebody on our side being gone, not getting the communication. Communication is going to be a problem, especially during the teeth of it. So we don't have any of those yet. So potential for blowers. So this is coming. You're probably going to see this in a budget request at some point, depending on a bunch of things. Downtown snow removal, while it's okay, it is pretty hectic, and it's pretty labor intense as far as how much stuff we have to put to bear. So we've evaluated some blowers over the years, and we're probably to that stage where we need to get one. A couple of reasons for that. We're also going to be taking over some items on I-70 in the winter of 28-29 that we're going to need some blowers to do those. So getting one sooner probably is testing it out. We set up a demo of a unit. A company out of St. Louis is going to come in and demo a unit for us. Hopefully this year, depending on logistics, it's going to be a little bit of a... the university is also looking into one, so you may see that out there, just to give you an idea. Give you an idea what they look like. This is the one that's on the left is what we're going to demo. It's a pretty small machine, can fit on a pretty narrow sidewalk. It may or may not be a good enough machine for all of what we're planning on doing, but we're probably looking at something like this for pedestrian-related activity on I-70. Then one of the other ones, a blower that's mounted on a wheel loader, and we'll move a lot of snow. Give you an idea, maybe $150,000 for the setup on the left, and maybe $280,000 for the setup on the right. Not with the bump, the dump truck. We're currently assessing the effectiveness of potassium acetate. Probably not the right thing for us. Potassium acetate is generally used for airports. Airport is using that. We really appreciated having some conversations with them about what they're doing. It's pretty expensive. It's about, in essence, it's about $80 a ton, $85 a ton for rock salt. In relation to that, it's about $1,000 a ton for potassium acetate, the same amount, but it's really effective too. It's liquid, it only is in liquid form. So calcium magnesium acetate can be in granular form, or magnesium chloride, which is what most communities use, is something that reaches a little deeper, effective to 0 degrees. But we need storage for that, because you can put it in the same thing, but you'd be wasting money. It's about about twice the cost of salt. So you use it when it's getting really cold, so you can set it aside. New salt dome facility, to get into that a little bit. So we do have a new salt dome facility that's under the way, hopefully going to be constructed here this next year. It's down by Mill Creek Elementary. Mill Creek Elementary is Sinclair and Nifon, to give you an idea. The facility, and even though it's on the south side of town, it's going to help the entire town, because to give you an idea, it takes about two and a half hours to go from Thornbrook to the salt dome and back. So that's time we're not out there plowing. We have a salt dome that's closer, less time on the road. And we can kind of split our forces and make sure that everybody's in the right spot. So that's what the eventual master plan looks like. What we're planning on doing this next year would be constructing the salt dome, which is it's not a salt dome. It's going to be it'll be a fabric building. That'll be a long fabric building. We'll hold 6,000 tons, so we'll have some magnesium chloride that'll be in there, as well as some salt, and then another operational building. So targeted opening that in the 2026-2027 winter. Currently in progress. Supply chain issues right now is making me pretty nervous. I'm not sure when it's coming. So I believe that is a shame to kind of talk a little bit. Public Works has a systematic and equitable approach. Plans carefully crafted based on a lot of information, many years, and this is historical data. We have 1 to 2% of days for Missouri, for Columbia, where snow over 4 inches stays on the ground. That's the average. So about 4 to 8 days out of the year where it stays on the ground. We have had other times where we have that really cold 2 week period, and we'll have a little bit of snow. Most of the time in Missouri, when you get really cold, you don't get a lot of volume of snow. So it robs the moisture out of the air. So when you have lots of volume of snow, most of the time you're in that 30 degree and you can do something with it. So we're having when an average or better occurs, but we're prepared for other snow. So I'll open it up to questions.
I know that was 22 minutes.
You let me start.
Real quick, slides 13 and 14, the ICS info, is that available on the public side or is that just internal for their use because of the...
It's meant to be an operational information. I mean, okay. It's necessary. I mean, it can be sunshine. We'll provide that to anybody that wants it. It's not meant for information out of the public because it's got things in there that are just specific to operators.
Okay, and that's understood. And then slide 19, where you talk about your equipment. So does that require, you mentioned CDLs, does that require a CDL for everything except the class fives?
No, the tandems and single axle are CDLs. The one tons and class fives do not require
CDL.
We're trying to figure out the best pieces of equipment that do not require CDLs, but a lot of that just does.
Okay, thanks.
On this slide, actually, you have the little asterisk. So does that mean that 14 includes the four that are on delivery, or it is 18?
Those are replacement. The four and the one are replacement, okay. But we're not going to actually take the ones that are in service out of service this year. We're going to keep them around.
Keep band-aiding.
To make sure there's, like, if we have a $20,000 differential, then we're probably not fixing it, right? If it's going to be shuttled to the auction, so we'll just let that sit and go ahead and shuttle it out later. Otherwise, we aren't trying to use it yet this year.
Yeah, Valerie and then Vera.
Have you reached out to the downtown CID for demoing that blower?
I haven't had those conversations with them yet, no.
Okay. Is that something that you could potentially do with a smaller blower prior to when the I-70 pedestrian walkways are completed?
Yeah, I don't have a date for the demo because I don't know when it's going to snow for one. Yeah. And then trying to make sure that the company gets the piece of equipment and can deliver it, working around all of that. So we're going to demo it. I don't even know that I'm going to demo it downtown. We may demo it in another location that's a little bit more contained. Like if I have to pull the trigger to actually remove from downtown, I'm gonna be focused on removing from downtown. Mm-hmm. So.
Is one of the potential intents behind having a blower to remove snow from walkways downtown as well? Or is that not
a walkways? It's to address our existing concerns. I mean, if council so directs us to do something different, then we'll try to figure out how to do it. So, from what it's going to take to do it.
What are the existing concerns, I guess existing as opposed to future concerns for I-70?
She got my question.
As far as, we've agreed, as the city has agreed, to take on the responsibility of adding bicycle pedestrian facilities across those bridges, mm-hmm. And we're going to be maintaining those. So we have a responsibility to maintain those in all weather conditions. So,
and our existing bicycle and ped facilities that are not parks, will we be maintaining those with the blowers as well?
I mean, right now we currently maintain some facilities that are adjacent to city properties, and different pieces of the city are responsible for that, depending on whether or not it's their adjacent parks to some, utilities to some. We do some, but there's no current plan to take on additional responsibility.
The places we have existing pedways, we currently treat those like we do sidewalks. The responsibility of the adjacent property owner is what I think you might have been getting at, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Yeah, I think we have some headways that are not well defined who's plowing them, perhaps.
Okay, Nick has a question.
About communications, if if a resident wants to communicate with the city about what's going on then in their neighborhood, how do they do that? And then I guess the other part of that is how's the city communicating to the public about anticipated impacts of snow and its removal?
Either way. So it's how we communicate. It's kind of how we communicate a lot of different things. Social media, press releases, those kind of things. As far as someone that wants to call in, as I think Richard covered earlier, typically what you would do is you call into the call center and, you know, but for the most part, during the teeth of a storm, we're going to do what we're going to do our plan. And so it's when we get done with what we've got planned that then we release those calls from the call center, bring those to us. And if there's something that we've, you know, we went in and did a cul-de-sac, but maybe people are still having trouble getting out, go and take a look at that. But if you release all those calls at once, you don't have a plan anymore. You're just reacting to whoever bothers to call in first. And so that's why we try to avoid that. We're going to do what we're going to do, and then we'll address it on the back end.
Yeah, so that map will be totally green, meaning that operationally, we're saying everything in town is passable. And we want it all to be passable, right? We've done the best possible job we can, given all the conditions, and we've gotten everybody to passable. If they think their street's not passable and they're contacting the contact center, then that goes out to street division and we want to know.
Yeah, so just the regular number into the city, to the contact center. How's a priority neighborhood determined?
So we have a process. If somebody says that, you know, they're upset that their neighborhood is never plowed, which I've had a lot of conversations with folks, and my street never gets plowed, and I've personally plowed your street. We'll give them the information. So we have a process. We provide an email. And if you want to see some of that, we can send it. I've shared that sometimes with council folks. They're responsible for them making sure that those they, on their end, they have whatever system they've got, either a neighborhood alert or whatever it is that they're telling people. My folks, as we're approaching the storm, are saying, hey, it looks like we're going to get into the neighborhood streets. It looks like we're going to have more than 4 inches of snow. We're on first and seconds now. Please warn your folks to remove the vehicles from the street. And then they'll contact that person that's contacted them and say, hey, our streets are clear of parked cars. As soon as that's done, we've got an opportunity to go in there and knock that neighborhood out. We do. So I work typically about 30 hours. So in the overnight hours, I'll be working. And then my superintendent, we overlap each other. We're having conversations, and then I've got some supervisors that are kind of special forces folks that knock out those neighborhoods when we've got those. Or sometimes we'll assign it to an operator that's in an area, depending on how big it is. So it kind of depends on the location, but they've got to do their part to make sure on the street those cars are off there. And then that's a really good thing for the entire community, right? They've got that off there. We can knock that out really fast. And I try to make that point to folks as we're approaching an event, if I'm on KFRU or whatever it is, it's like, hey, if you would please not park on the street, that'll speed up our process. So.
Rich, related to that, you mentioned, you know, maybe we have too many. So how many do we have? And then the follow-up to that is, how do you evaluate success rate for it versus the times when, you know, there are cars parked and then does somebody get removed from the list?
We've got about 25 this year. There's been a few that have requested to be in it. We've still got a couple lingering that in the past have not done their part or have not even had any contact with us, but we've kept them on the list because somebody at some point took that step. At some point, we're gonna tell them, you know, you're removed from the priority neighborhood system. But if they want to all of a sudden start doing it, it will improve the response time for everybody if we can do that. So, but there's only there is a limit on how much we do. Like all 25 of them said, all the cars are removed. It's like we're still going to get to them prior to the inside to out or outside to in, depending on where they are, but maybe not too much more. So.
And then following up on Nick's question about the call, like calling in, this might actually be a Stephanie Browning answer, is part of the script for the contact center respondents to say, like, the process for first in priority and then you're be released?
Yes, it is. So we have while we're waiting for them to release, where we can release the questions to the streets department, we have a set standard script that we just give to all callers based on the amount of snow. So if it's working on priority streets, we give out that information. If they're working on neighborhoods, we give out that information as well.
And then they know that their address is not being sent on yet until they get to that point. Do that, you know what I mean? Are they aware, or are they just kind of like, okay, but they just assume that they're coming?
They're aware. We do provide that information, that we're just sending out information to residents and citizens. If there's an out of ordinary or extraordinary situation on a street, we do send those over, as Rich was saying. If it's like a semi-emergency, we'll send those over as well immediately. So we also collect addresses if they are wanting them us to report that to them, so that we can send it over in one shot when we're released to let streets know that information.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and from an emergency response perspective, fire department has two plow vehicles on their own, and they'll also contact us. So we're in contact with that emergency response side of the equation. There used to be a lot of the hospitals had plows too for their ambulances. They do not, so we still work with Joint Communications on those responses. But the possibility that some people like to throw out, that I'm not going to be able to have somebody get to me because of snow on the street. I mean, it could be delayed, but we're working with Joint Communications, the fire department, ambulances to try to address those concerns. Still winter weather, so could be delayed.
I got just a little bit of battery.
Okay.
From an emergency standpoint, I think what's important to understand is if you have an emergency, you need to call 911. And police and fire and ambulance know exactly who to call us when they need us.
Yeah.
And so, because otherwise you get a lot of phone calls, or you can, where there's an emergency that maybe isn't quite an emergency. So we'd rather run that through our emergency services. And if they need us, they're going to reach out to us and we'll pull off and go help them. But we want that to run that way.
Okay, great. And then my last question is just on the what we use for treating the streets. Didn't we used to use like beet juice or something? Like, whatever happened to that?
We actually we're kind of phasing out of beet juice because of the manufacturing process. There's some pulp problems with beet juice again. At one point when it first started, there were pulp problems that basically clogged the nozzles. But from a brine perspective, we still use brine. In order for our salt to activate, it needs wet. It needs some sort of thermal activation. So you're actually putting water out when it's really cold, right? Don't do that. But if you have the specific salt content in brine, then it activates it faster. So we're doing that pre-wetting our salt when that's going out. And we were using beet juice. We're kind of phasing out of that because, again, it went for a little while where it was really great. Now it's back to where it's not so great. So we're looking at other chemicals. There are a couple other chemicals out there that are a little bit better. But again, delivery mechanisms, storage mechanisms, all that stuff has to be taken into account. So actually salt brine at 23.3% is the thing to use.
for staff?
Beet was really good because it had a little bit of sugar in it. It was a little sticky, so it helped stick the salt. But there's some other processes that
operational
things. Yeah.
Any other questions for staff on this? Nope, appreciate it. And we know we'll still get calls or emails regardless of what happens, but appreciate you putting the information out there and the proactiveness. I would just say, you know, I think what we saw similar to the end of last year's season, it was really helpful when staff would proactively send council members kind of like update status updates, because we're getting those emails. And if we can just all be saying the same thing, that is extremely helpful for us. And I hope you. So, all right, we'll go ahead. Anything else for pre-council? All right, we'll go ahead and adjourn this one at 6:35.